Bring It On is a public affairs program exploring the people, issues, and events affecting the African-American communities in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Bring It On is a forum for the people, by the people, produced by an independent team of volunteers working at the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana,
and financially supported by listeners like you.
Good evening. I'm Clarence Boone, and welcome to Bring It On, a multiple award-winning radio broadcast in our 19th year as Indiana's only weekly community radio show committed to exploring the people, issues, and events impacting the African-American community.
Hello, and good evening. I'm Liz Mitchell. Jesse Hogopian has been an educator for over 20 years and taught for a decade at Seattle's Garfield High School and the site of the historic boycott of the MAP test, or Measures of Academic Progress. Jesse is an editor for the social justice periodical Rethinking Schools and is the co-editor of the books Black Lives Matter at School, Teaching for Black Lives, Teacher Unions and Social Justice, and is the editor of the book More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing.
Jesse's essay on the MAP test boycott and the ensuing national uprising against high stakes testing was published in Howard Zinn and Anthony Arnoff's 10th anniversary edition of Voices of a People's History of the United States. Jesse's commentary has been featured on many local and national news programs, including HBO's Problem Areas with Wyatt Cenick, NBC's Education Nation, the PBS NewsHour with Gwen Ifill, CNN, Keith Olbermann's Countdown, the Dan Rather Report, Democracy Now!, The Real News Network, Busted Pencils, The Laura Flanders Show, and C-SPAN's Book TV, and I may add now with Bring It On.
On January 15th of 2024, the city of Bloomington will observe the MLK birthday, Martin Luther King Jr. birthday celebration, with the theme of Unlocking Freedom, the transformative and liberating power of education. Jesse Hogopian will inform and inspire during the special remarks. He joins us this evening for a discussion on his passionate work in transforming education and what he envisions for the year of 2024. Jesse, thank you so much for being here and welcome to Bring It On.
Oh, thank you so much for that warm welcome. I'm really glad to be with you both.
And as I read through your condensed biography, you have done a lot for a person of your age. You are not even out of your 20s, I would say. You've accomplished all these things. No, actually, he is not in his 20s. But to read this lengthy list and to see him, we have the luxury of having Zoom. He's a young man and has achieved so much in a relatively brief period of time. And I wanted to know, just right from the start, please tell us who Jesse is and how Jesse got so involved with trying to transform education in America.
Well, thank you for that question. I never thought I would have been a teacher. As a young person growing up in Seattle, Washington, I really had a negative experience with education. I rarely saw myself in the curriculum. Black history was rare in most of my K-12 education. And so I never really saw a connection between myself and school. The only reason I went was because my friends were there or to play baseball. But the academics never spoke to me. And it wasn't until I finally took a class in college called The Black Experience Since World War II and had an opportunity to hear a guest lecture from one of the founders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that I really reflected on all that they had risked during the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement so that I could be where I was. And that reflection made me think, how am I going to give back to those in the future as well? And I went into teaching as one way I thought I might be able to give back. But, you know, I ended up learning more than I taught those first few years teaching. I was teaching in Washington, D.C. I went to Anacostia and taught in Southeast DC in one of the most impoverished neighborhoods in the nation. And the lessons that I learned were profound. I would pass the White House on my way to this forsaken land. And 10 minutes later, I'm in a school where there was a hole in the ceiling of my classroom. And I didn't know that there was a hole until I came in one Monday that first fall. And there was standing water all over the ground. And the first assignment I had ever assigned these children was a research project for them to create a poster to tell me something about someone they admired from history who had helped make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. And they were supposed to present those posters on that Monday, but they were all destroyed because of the rain. And, you know, what I learned is that our nation had untold billions of dollars for wars around the world, for bailing out banks, and for the very powerful, but they didn't have the money in the nation's capital to fix the hole in my ceiling. In fact, I had a work order in for 3 years, and I just had to have a industrial sized garbage can under that hole. And I've just seen every year since then, the really misplaced priorities in this country that can find money for all sorts of destructive things, but not to nurture our nation's youth. And that led me to want to be part of a struggle to transform the priorities of this country and to transform public education.
I have one follow-up, and then I'm going to turn this over to Liz. Jesse, I remember when the argument used to be getting the information highway to have an off-ramp at your school, because it seemed like everyone had internet access except your school. You know, some had working computers, except we had huge, just paperweights because they didn't work and they weren't fast enough to support the internet. And so other kids were doing research or learning history on the internet. Here our kids were just trying to get systems and machines to just come on. And so now, I don't know, do we now have an even playing field, would you say, as far as the digital divide that used to exist? Has that divide come together, or what's your observation on that?
No, I think the disparities are still very much there. And the COVID-19 pandemic really exposed the dramatic disparities that exist between communities, you know, with Black kids in highly segregated schools across the country that are also very underfunded and lacking the equipment. And, you know, many Black and brown children and poor children of all races were not able to participate in the remote schooling, right? And I think for some, that was the first time that they began to see this digital divide, that we still have a long, long way to go to properly address, and as well as so many other inequalities. I mean, the fact that not every school has a nurse every day in my hometown of Seattle, we're talking about a city of Microsoft, Boeing, Starbucks, Amazon, like all these wealthy corporations. And we are in this global pandemic has hit our school system and our world. And yet there still isn't a nurse in every school in every building. So the basic infrastructure to support our youth, whether it's their educational and academic outcomes, or it's their health, those things are severely lacking.
Wow. Now, you just hit upon one of my questions. And that is talking about in most cities, I assumed as most cities, the schools are segregated like it was when I came up, because I grew up under segregation. So we got that part of the question done. Would you agree that this, it seems like what you're saying, this has to do with power and money and the 1% keeping everyone else in the dark while they forge ahead and their children forge ahead? You think this is done on purpose?
No, that's exactly right. Our schools today are more segregated than at any time since 1968, and the schools are funded with property taxes, right? And so that means that schools in wealthy areas are funded properly. You know, they are able to have the arts and music. They're able to have advanced classes. But the schools in impoverished neighborhoods, they don't get the same school funding. And that basic formula is at the root of the inequality in our school system. And we've seen a growing movement around this country that increasingly looks like the massive resistance movement back in the 50s and 60s to refuse to integrate the schools, where we see groups like Moms for Liberty trying to stop any Black education from happening, trying to ban any book that mentions the struggle against racism and other forms of oppression. And so I think very much so this inequality is being orchestrated by the richest 1%. They know what good education looks like. They send their kids to very well-funded schools, but they believe that only their kids should have access to schools with state-of-the-art computer labs and science labs and theater production classes and all of the arts and sciences that are needed to fully develop their own children. But they want to reserve those access to education for the elite. And that's really the struggle that we're in today.
You know, to me, it seems
That's a repeat of what happened hundreds of years ago in Europe.
Yeah,
they hadn't learned the lessons. There was a revolt against that hundreds of years ago over in Europe. So would you agree or not agree that it's not only geared toward African-Americans, but anybody poor, regardless of their race?
Absolutely. I think that we've seen this inequality in many different communities that are struggling with poverty and, you know, including white communities. You know, white children have the highest number of kids in poverty. Now, disproportionately, the number of Black and brown kids live in poverty, but they're because of the mass poverty that face kids from a lot of different racial backgrounds, there's also the potential for solidarity between communities. If they were able to join together to, take down the racism that's dividing the communities and come together, That's where the power would lie to challenge the elites, who are very few, even if their bank accounts are very big. And so we hope that kind of a multiracial struggle can be built in order to get the resources that all of our kids deserve.
I wanted to follow up on something you said. Just real quickly, you had said that schools are lacking in areas of arts and music, the high technical equipment needed to put, say, theater productions together. And I would assume that no real emphasis on STEM type of learning. And maybe the prevailing thought is with the elites that, well, as long as that scant few can dribble the ball, run the football, run with a baton in their hand, we've done our job. We've given them an out. But athletics is not the answer for the Black and tan communities. We want an even playing field.
Yeah, I think that those who control the education system and the economic system of this country are quite comfortable with an education system that produces Black people to entertain them, whether that's on the sports field or whatnot, and then the vast majority of people to be trained in with basic literacy so that they can enter into low-wage jobs and make corporations unfathomably wealthy, right? They don't want students to develop critical thinking skills. to learn about the incredible struggles for democracy that Black people have led throughout U.S. history, because that kind of knowledge could lead to them creating new struggles today for social justice. And they would prefer that students only learn a very minimal set of skills that will allow them to be low-wage workers. And we have a different vision as educators for the school system, one that's about empowering our youth to create a different society that's based on equity, where people can work together and not have a situation like we do today, where you have a handful of billionaires who have as much wealth as the bottom half of humanity right now. And that inequality is creating so much strife for the bottom half of humanity that needs this basic wealth to eat, to live, to survive. And the cruelty of it is just really unfathomable.
And for those listening that may say, oh, he's just a socialist. Oh, he's just saying we're going to redistribute wealth and take away from those who earned it. What I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that no, those that have wealth, not to sequester or to phase others out from trying to achieve some degree of wealth, be it, say, owning a home, generating wealth for your family, instead of placing restrictive guidelines to prevent home ownership, or not even trying to create possibilities for home ownership. But a lot of people, they'll cry that foul. They'll say, well, no, you're just a socialist. Yeah. You're just trying to redesign American society. What's your response to that?
Well, we've seen the history of McCarthyism and red baiting in this country be so destructive to movements for social justice. In the late 40s and early 50s in this country, there was a hysteria that gripped the U.S. It was the Red Scare. And the whole point of it was to label someone a communist so that you could fire them from their jobs who were struggling for a better world. So there were thousands of teachers across the U.S. who were fired after having been labeled communist, including over 400 teachers in New York City alone. And these were teachers who were teaching kids about racial justice. They believed that Jim Crow segregation should be abolished, that the oppression of Black people needed to be challenged. These were people who saw income inequality and a wealthy few living high while many were suffering, and believed that kids had a right to engage in discussion and debate about how their society is organized. And instead of allowing that reasonable discussion and debate from happening, they quickly moved to this anti-communist hysteria. And we're seeing that repeated today, right? And we're seeing how the term critical race theory has now been weaponized against educators in much the same way the term communism was used to fire thousands of teachers back in the 40s and 50s. And if we don't learn that history, we will quickly descend into the type of paranoia and hysteria that existed in the McCarthy era.
I was on a discussion with a group of people about woke and on a panel for the NAACP about critical race theory. To me, I don't understand politicizing woke, because to me, it simply means you're paying attention.
That's it.
So if you criticize woke, you're criticizing me for paying attention. How ridiculous is that?
Hey, it is so ridiculous. It reminds me of that movie, Don't Look Up, where there's a asteroid hurtling towards the Earth, and some of the politicians decide that the best answer to that meteor hurtling towards the Earth is to not look up, right? So today's politicians are saying the answer is to not pay attention, to stay asleep, right? Yeah. They're arguing we should not be awake and we should not see what's happening to us. And it takes a dystopian film to explain the kind of absurd argument that they're advancing right now. to try to discredit any kind of racial justice.
I wanted to bring this up, and then I'll turn it over to Clarence, because I could keep you all day. We have a woman up in Indianapolis, and I have permission to use her name. Her name is Pat Payne, Patricia Payne, with the Indianapolis school system. She wants to retire, but she said, I can't. She doesn't care for charter schools. And she thinks that people are not paying attention, that they're listening to the rhetoric about, oh, it's so great. She is all 100% for public education. Tell me what you think about public schools versus charter schools. And then Clarence got to do a ID.
Well, I think your friend Pat Payne is brilliant. And I think she's right on target, because I've studied the history of the, quote, school choice movement. And that term school choice is used to talk about charter schools today, but it originally came from the massive resistance movement of white families refusing to go to integrated schools after the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And so they wanted the choice to flee from the public school system, and they wanted the government to fund their attendance in private schools so that they could be outside of the integrated school system. And we know today that the charter schools today are more segregated than even the public schools are. We know that charter schools today, from many different studies, have shown that they push out Black kids, kids with disabilities, at far higher rates than the public school system. And we also know fundamentally that the way charter schools are organized is they take public school funds and they place them in the hands of privately run charter operators. And this is a basic subversion of democracy. Now, I'm not here telling you that the public school system is doing the job it needs to do, especially for Black kids in this country. We have a long way to go to transform the education experience in the public school systems for Black kids. But I know that we're not going to get there using an invention of the white supremacist movement resisting integration. And I know we're not going to get there by more of the neoliberal policies that are about privatizing our public resources and are about union busting. These are not the solutions for our communities.
If you've just joined us here on Bring It On, we're having a very educational, and I borrow that word, discussion with Jesse Hagopian, who's an educational activist, public speaker, and author. He's joined us to share his passionate work in transforming education. And also, Jesse will be delivering remarks during the 2024 City of Bloomington MLK Birthday Observance. The citywide theme, once again, is unlocking freedom, the transformative and liberating power of education. You began to go down a path that I'm very interested to hear more on, and that is just the subtle constraints and the subtle barriers that are being placed. And you look around nationally, you see all the news about the school board disruptions and the dynamics playing out and just trying to vote school board members on, or certain groups commandeering school board meetings. And of course, there is the embarrassing debacle that's playing out now in Florida with the school board president and their outside school board activities that are bringing great shame to their family. But nevertheless, across the nation, that seems to be the point where the battle's being taken by extreme right movements to commandeer school boards, to put in school board commissioners and board members that will retard the educational advancement of some communities. And what's your answer to that? What's your observation of that? And then your answer to that.
Yes, absolutely. The attack on anti-racist education that's happening right now across the country is absolutely breathtaking. It is so outrageous that a dystopian story that you once would have thought was just fantastical, like the book Fahrenheit 451, where firefighters burn books, right? Or the book 1984, where the state declares ignorance is strength. These are quickly becoming our reality in the U.S. without hyperbole, you have to consider that the state of Florida has now made teaching that slavery was a, quote, personal benefit to Black people, the official curriculum of the state. It's hard to even believe the words that I just said, but that's the reality. In Florida, it is a felony if a teacher gets caught with the wrong book in their classroom about race, gender, or sexuality. Teachers would face a $5,000 fine and 5 years in jail if they get caught. They banned AP African American Studies in Florida. And it's not just Florida. It's all across the country. Over half of all students in public schools, almost half of public school students in the U.S. are affected by one of these anti-history, anti-truth laws that are being imposed either at the state house level or the school board level that seek to ban teachers' ability to teach the truth about Black history or about LGBTQ identity. And it's really breathtaking to see how many books have been banned all across the country. In Texas, one of the school libraries was turned into a detention center. I had a friend teaching in Iowa, not the South, right? But in Iowa, who was teaching the book Stamped from the Beginning about the history of racist ideas, and was getting attacked by a state senator. So he asked his superintendent if they could have a meeting so he could get clarity on what he was able to teach. And thankfully it was recorded. So everybody can watch it now and decide for themselves. But in that meeting, he asked the superintendent, is it okay that I teach that slavery was wrong? And the breathtaking answer from the superintendent that is an opinion, right, really has to be seen to be believed. And so this attack is occurring all over the country. The Washington Post identified over 160 educators who were fired, pushed out of their classroom for wanting to teach the truth about race, gender, or sexuality. And that was over a year ago. So we know there's many more since then, and many others who have gone unrecorded because the attack is pretty intense right now on anybody who wants students to be able to have an honest engagement with difficult truths about this nation's history of structural racism.
Well, Jesse, I want to switch it over to the math test boycott. I looked at that. I thought, like you said, that was awesome that everybody joined in. And then when they threatened you guys and said, you know, we're going to cut your pay, we're going to suspend you. And it was like, okay. And then everybody joined in and go, okay. Okay. And then when everybody joined in, that made that fool back up. Yeah, I love that. What you said about the high stakes testing. Tell us what's the purpose? What was the purpose of high stakes testing?
Yeah. Thank you for raising this. You know, the MAP test boycott was one of the most exhilarating experiences of my life and really helped me understand what it's going to take to create a better school system. So, you know, there are a myriad of high stakes tests that students have to take. And, you know, the No Child Left Behind Act really ushered in an era of test and punish in this country. And unfortunately, it was only escalated with the Race to the Top program. And we're in a situation in America where the average public school student now takes a staggering 112 standardized tests in their K-12 career. When I was in school, we had like the CAT test in elementary school. We took another one in middle school, and then we had a couple in high school, including the SAT, right? So you might have taken 5 or 6. Now we have 112. The explosion of high-stakes testing in our schools is all about companies like Pearson profiting off of the sale of these tests. Meanwhile, they're being marketed as accountability measures to hold teachers and students accountable for learning. But of course, they've designed an accountability system that holds those with the most power unaccountable. And so who will be accountable for the fact that our class sizes are through the roof and it's difficult to teach kids and get them to learn everything they deserve to learn when there's not even enough chairs in your classroom for the kids, as has happened to me on numerous occasions, right? Who is going to be accountable for the fact that kids don't have the computer and technology that they deserve to have, right? There's so many inequalities that are exacerbating disparate educational outcomes that they don't want to discuss. And they instead just want to use this test and punish strategy. And at Garfield, we said no. So the MAP test was one of these many tests that the kids had to take, but it was a computer administered test. And so it had the additional problem of monopolizing all of our computer labs in the building for the test being administered 3 times a year, including the computer lab in the library. So our library was shut down, so we couldn't use the library for research for weeks at a time. And this test was just so disruptive. So our reading specialist, who was an incredible teacher, Mallory Clark, who got kids from way below grade level reading on track at their grade level reading, often in just 1 year. And she really built relationships with the kids and sat with them. And she told me, guess what I use if I want to know what reading level they're at? I don't use the MAP test. I use the revolutionary technology of the book. And I have them actually read out loud to me. And then I know what their reading level is. And she told me, I'm going to refuse to give this test. It's a waste of time and resources, and it shames them when they get scores back rather than helping them. And so we organized a school-wide boycott, and every single teacher refused to give the test. And they threatened the educators and the tested subjects of math and reading with a 10-day suspension without pay. And not a single teacher, not even the first-year teachers who didn't have tenure, backed down. We had the support of the NAACP of Seattle, the Black Student Union, the PTA of Garfield High School voted to support us, and the boycott spread to several other schools, so that by the end of the year, the pressure was so immense from hundreds of educators all across the country, hundreds of students and parents writing our school board, that by the end of the year, not only did they not reprimand a single educator, but they got rid of the MAP test for Seattle's high schools altogether. And it was just a resounding victory for us. And it helped to spark a broader opt-out movement, so that parents now are saying all across the country, we are going to opt our kids out of taking these high-stakes tests. We would rather spend the millions of dollars that you waste on ranking and sorting our children. We'd rather take that money and use it to lower class size, use it to hire tutors and other wraparound services.
I wanted you to explain to it, and then after this question, it's on you, Clarence. I heard you mentioning about wraparound programs. Could you please tell our listening audience what the vision is for wraparound programs? And this is it to replace testing.
Yes, okay. Yes, absolutely. We can take all the money that's wasted on high stakes testing and use that to help provide wraparound services. And this is a vision for community schools, where the schools not only provide an education, but are also places that have healthcare centers in them, that families can go there and see their school as a resource for their well-being, both educationally and physically. We think that schools could have not only healthcare clinics and dental clinics, but they could have after-school tutoring programs, mentorship programs that help develop the whole child, and provide the school psychologists and the mental health supports that we need to have healthy, thriving communities.
You know, I'm sitting here listening and shaking my head as far as what groups are being allowed to get away with. And I'm thinking, okay, how are they being allowed to get away? Well, it's easy to point a finger at politicians. It's easy to point a finger at the school boards. But what is driving all this? And for years, we've heard in the United States slipping and worldwide rankings regarding education and how we're now in the lower tier and it's at a crisis moment. We need to do something to, again, regain our status as a worldwide producer of educated kids. And is this an accurate measurement that we're being evaluated on? And do you feel it's being used to justify some of the emotional, oppressive, high-stakes testing that we see going on?
Yeah, that's an important question. I want to say a couple things about that. First, we should know the origins of standardized testing because it reveals so much about how they're being used today. And so the history is very clear. Standardized testing entered the public school system in the early 1900s as a direct product of the eugenics movement, an openly white supremacist movement that wanted to develop a strategy for proving white supremacy. And so a man named Carl Brigham was a student at Princeton, and he began developing these tests and these in what he called intelligence tests. And he first used them during World War I on all of the army recruits. And they used his testing to discern who would be an officer and who would be a grunt soldier that could go die in the trenches. And then when the war was over, he established himself in a position at Princeton. He wrote a book called A Study in American Intelligence that lamented that America's intelligence was going to be eroded because we had so many Black people in this country and we would fall far behind Europe. And he is the developer and the author of the SAT exam, right? And that is why many Black intellectuals organized and fought against standardized testing. People like W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the leaders in the struggle against these tests that to this very day do not measure intelligence and do not measure even academic learning, but instead measure your proximity to white middle-class culture, right? The questions on the test and the way the tests are developed have been shown by countless studies to measure your zip code, right? These tests are a far better measure of your zip code than anything else, meaning your proximity to wealth, what neighborhood you live in, and how wealthy it is than your intelligence. But we worship these exams in America as telling us something about the innate intelligence of people, when in fact they are reflections of a deeply unequal society. And, you know, they often talk about the crisis that is occurring in public education, and they point to these tests and they use that to privatize education. So if they can show the public schools are failing because of these tests, then they can convince parents that they need to pull their kids out of the public schools and send them to privatized charters. So they're very much connected to the privatization movement as well.
And for those who joined us again, we're having a conversation with Jesse Hoghopian, an educational activist, public speaker, and author. He has joined us to share his passionate work into how he is transforming education. And he's also delivering remarks during the 2024 City of Bloomington MLK birthday observance. Once again, the citywide theme is Unlocking Freedom, the transformative and liberating power of education. And one final follow up, and then I'll hand this over to Liz. We talk about the origins of the SAT tests. We talk about the origins of just, well, forces to suppress the Black race and to justify the suppression of Black race, eugenics being one. And of course, here in Bloomington, we've gone round and round at IU with the origins of, well, some of our former trustees from days gone by being advocates of eugenics, and even the Nazi regime studying our research into eugenics, and how they even justify having these summer camps called Holocaust camps to send people who were the despised in the society, who were mentally challenged, who may look differently than you and I. But I want to go back to where it seemed that the rebellion, the pushback against these SAT tests, to the extent that I, if I'm not mistaken, some colleges now are saying that we won't use the SAT test as the primary indicative test for entering students. Is that true? Is that something that we should celebrate, or is that being replaced by something different? Is it more of a nuanced type of response to get everybody to put their guard down? But what's your thought on that?
Well, yeah, I do think that it's a victory when schools no longer require the SAT to be admitted to their campus. And I think it's a direct result of this mass uprising of parents, students, and educators all over the country who have pointed out that these tests are deeply flawed. And I think that's why more and more campuses have gotten rid of these requirements. We've also had victories against some of the high stakes. So many states at one time had a requirement that you had to pass one of these high stakes tests to graduate. And it didn't matter if you had a 4.0 GPA. If you didn't pass one of these tests, you didn't graduate. And many of those state exit exams have also been struck down because of this movement. And so I do think that's an important advance of our struggle. And I think the caution that was in your question is warranted as well, because I think there's schools that have reinstated some of the tests, have begun to use other tests, and we have to stay vigilant and make sure that people know the history of where these exams came from, how they're being used to reproduce inequality, and what the alternatives can be. Because as an educator, I definitely want to know what my students have learned. It's just that an ABCD bubble test teaches me if the student is good at eliminating wrong answer choices, but it doesn't teach me if they can think critically, if they can put a thesis together and back it up with evidence. And so I want to have forms of assessment that are truly authentic to the learning experience. And so in my classroom and in other classrooms where people believe in authentic assessment, they use assessments like performance-based assessments, which is an assessment that many people are familiar with. They just don't know it, right? Because when you get your PhD, what do? At that level, they actually want to know, can you think? They don't want to know, can you eliminate wrong answer choices at a better rate than another student? So at that level, they have you develop a thesis. They have you work with a mentor. They have you write your thesis. And then if the evidence that you discover refutes your thesis, you have to revise your thesis. And then you have to defend your thesis at the end of a period. And this is exactly what social justice educators are doing all over the country. They are having kids think deeply about different topics and create thesis statements, do research, and then defend their mini dissertation on an age-appropriate level to the class. And some innovative programs, like in New York City, the consortium schools have a waiver and they don't have to give the standardized tests. And they actually bring in authors from New York to come sit in on panels for their language arts class, so that these students can get feedback from people in the field about their subject area. Think about that kind of assessment, as opposed to some corporation in some far off place determining whether the student is educated or not.
Great. Well, Jesse, I want you to make a connection here for me and for our listening audience, mainly for me. Redlining, half the schools, public schools being in poverty, and mass incarceration.
Oh, wow.
Connect those dots.
That's a really important exercise in connecting the dots. And redlining is one of the tools that was used the most to extract wealth from the Black community and enforce poverty on Black people for so long. And that's precisely why they don't want us to teach about redlining and why these attacks on anti-racist education, these attacks on critical race theory are occurring, because once students learn how redlining was used to perpetuate poverty, to extract wealth from Black families by keeping Black people in neighborhoods with falling property values, then they will see that is a huge part of mass incarceration, right? When people are desperate because intergenerational wealth was deprived from them because of policies like redlining, then they sometimes have to resort to illegal means to make ends meet. And then we have a system of mass incarceration ready to scoop them up and tear them away from their families and communities. And so I think that we have to connect those dots, and we have to allow children to learn about how this society has functioned and the role of structural racism from not just the days of enslavement, but through Jim Crow and the way it continues today with mass incarceration.
And the reason I brought that up is because I've been told and I've heard several times that they know how many jails to build by looking at second and third grade classes. So I'm thinking, okay, there's a connection here with education. If they know that, then why not flip the script?
Yeah, I know that the priorities of our society are way out of whack, right? We know that there is billions just being wasted on locking children away, on locking men, women, and non-gender conforming people away. And if you think about the billions invested in the prison industrial complex, it's just staggering to think what could be done with that money to nurture our young people from a young age so that they would never end up in those facilities. But I believe that for some, they believe that punishment is the way to maintain our current inequality. And so for them, the investment in caging a generation of people is worth it so that they can keep their wealth. And the impact on our youth is just so tragic. It just is hard to even explain how frustrating it is to see here in Seattle, they built a brand new youth jail to lock up children just a few blocks away from the high school where I teach at. And if they invested those hundreds of millions of dollars they spent to build that facility to lock children away instead into lowering class size so we can build relationships with the kids, if they had invested it in those wraparound services that I had talked about and job programs for our youth, we wouldn't have kids in those facilities and they would be living happy, healthy, thriving lives. And that's really the vision that we're in the struggle for, to decarcerate our education system and our society and build a system that nurtures all kids.
You know, Liz, I could continue that sort of connect the dot scenario. When you look at the crime measurements that are just going through the roof now, where young are taking out young, and you and I both live, 50 miles from Indianapolis, and I'm appalled every morning to hear, to read and see about the shootings that are going on. Youth shooting youth, and in our communities in particular. So, you know, the cessation of life, the devaluation of life, and the fact that, and our governor spearheaded this. I don't need a permit to purchase. There's no background check necessary. So anybody can go in and get a weapon and solve my issues the old-fashioned way. Now, are we getting away from the discussion of education? No. No. I will say this. We have not talked this evening, and we have a few minutes left, about how First Nation community, tribal communities, we're suffering here in a large way. I dare think that they're suffering much more. Am I right, Jesse?
No, I'm really glad you raised that, because this attack that's happening on critical race theory, on anti-racist education, is not the first time, right? And I think it definitely happened when the first laws were passed in 1740 to deny Black people the access to literacy and made it illegal to be able to read and write for Black folks. But one of the most brutal examples of the attacks on education is the boarding schools in the United States and across Canada that stole children, sometimes as young as 4 years old, away from their Native American families.
That's right.
Right? Ripped them out of their families and took them to these Native American boarding schools that were designed to destroy their culture. And just, just a horrific genocide that was perpetrated on youth. And, you know, if they spoke their own language, their tongue was smacked. They had their heads shaved. So the traditional hair that was so part of their culture was taken from them. And they were taught to believe in America and our government, and had their religion and cultural practices stripped from them. And now, in the last couple of years, they've discovered mass graves at many of these boarding school sites across Canada and the United States, with thousands of dead children. And it just horrific revelation. And the pain that has resulted from that experience still endures. And people should know these are not an ancient relic. The last boarding school wasn't closed until the 1970s. So this is a very recent history that is still impacting Native communities across the country.
Jesse, we have time for one last question. I'm going to defer to Liz for that question. And we'll just have to invite you back to tell us.
Anytime.
Yeah.
From the Biden administration and other administrations. But I'm going to let Liz ask the final question. I think I just snuck the final question in. Go ahead. Go right ahead. I know I do. Go ahead.
You mentioned in several things I've watched you, and even you mentioned today, but I looked at several of your videos, No Child Left Behind. Whose great idea was that? And then from that, it went into Race to the Top program, both failures, in my opinion. But who started that No Child Left Behind? Because I remember, can't remember what year it was, but I remember that program.
Yeah, that was one of the worst ideas. And George W. Bush started it, and it went online the first year I began teaching in Washington, D.C. So I had an intimate look at how they were trying to blame me and the educators around me for the outcomes of the students, rather than blaming the priorities that underfunded the schools, right? And so that was incredible to start my teaching career right down the street from the halls of government, right, and see the way they were shifting the blame from their failure to fully fund education to the educators. And so they got the idea that if the schools weren't performing based on these tests, then they would close the schools altogether. And places like Chicago, they ended up closing 50 schools, just decimating the hearts of so many communities. Instead of infusing those schools with the resources they would need to thrive, they just cut the funding or closed those schools altogether based on the test scores. And this has been a bipartisan effort. You know, George W. Bush pushed it, but unfortunately, the Democrats in Congress voted almost unanimously for No Child Left Behind. And then in the Obama administration with the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, he forged ahead with many of the No Child Left Behind policies and made it worse, as you said, with the race to the top. And so we are still in the wake of those destructive education policies and need to reverse course and do more child-centered policies that can uplift all of our youth, and especially Black and brown youth who have been relegated to segregated and underfunded schools.
And on that note, we want to thank Jesse Hagopian, educational activist, public speaker, and author, for joining us to share his passionate work in transforming education and his well-adept skills at answering two questions in one response. And also, Jesse will also deliver remarks during the 2024 City of Bloomington MLK Birthday Observance. And the citywide theme, once again, is Unlocking Freedom, the Transformative and Liberating Power of Education.
Bringing On has an open submission policy, so if you have an idea for this program, let's hear it. Send an email to our volunteer staff. We want to make sure we share everything and anything affecting the African-American community, along with our listening audience in Bloomington and beyond. The email address is bringiton@wfhb.org.
If you have an event or happening that the African-American community should know about, please send the info directly to our Bring It On staff. Or if you want additional information about tonight's guests, contact us at bringiton@wfhb.org.
Our show's executive producer is none other than Clarence Boone. Our assistant producer is myself, Liz Mitchell. Our consultant and WFHB News Department director is Cade Young. Our program engineer is Chantal LaFontant. Our original theme music was created by Jamal Ephraim, with additional background tracks by David Baker. For WFHB, I'm Liz Mitchell.
And I'm Clarence Boone. Be sure to tune in next Monday at 6 p.m. for another edition of Bring It On right here on your community radio station, WFHB.
You've been listening to Bring It On, a volunteer-powered production of community radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Bring It On is your forum for open dialogue on the people, issues, and events affecting the African-American community in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas directly to the Bring It On staff. The email address is bringit@wfhb.org.
That's bringit@wfhb.org.